Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
If you were to leave the sanctuary through the main doors and head east, skirting the public garden and angling across the common in barely half a mile, you might find yourself at West Street, which connects Tremont and Washington Streets. One of the less imposing structures on this unexceptional street, 13 West Street, still displays a sign for Papagayo, a restaurant that closed several years back, the edifice now grimy and padlocked, the windows obscured by a rusting metal grate. A small plaque on the facade informs the alert passerby that 13 West Street was once the site of Elizabeth Peabody's bookshop. Quote, a meeting place for transcendentalists and intellectuals. Journalist Margaret Fuller gave lectures here called Conversations, which were an important part of the early American feminist movement. All true, so far as it goes. But in reciting so dispassionately the bare facts, in failing utterly to invoke the courage and consequence, the insurgency and inspiration, the resolve and revolution of what transpired there from 1839 to 1844, that plaque not only disappoints, I think it demeans the astonishing and audacious legacy of Margaret Fuller. Born in 1810, at 71 Cherry Street in Cambridge, Sarah Margaret Fuller changed who we are today. As a religious movement and as a people, we are more just, more egalitarian, more compassionate, because Margaret Fuller lived. Her father was a prominent attorney and later United States Senator. Her mother, a demure beauty well-trained in domestic skills. Neither one ever knew quite what to make of their precocious daughter. By age 5, she was reading adult books. By age 6, reciting Virgil to her father after his evening tea. Striving to satisfy his perfectionism, she began to experience nightmares, sleepwalking, and piercing headaches, the last of which plagued her all of her life. When her parents left for Washington, 11-year-old Margaret was dispatched to Dr. Park's School for Girls in Boston, where she outshone her classmates in academics, but lagged in social graces. Her friend William Henry Channing, nephew of the Reverend William Ellery Channing, who served this church for 4 decades, William Henry Channing recalled her predicament. She was considered a prodigy of talent and accomplishment, but a sad feeling prevailed that she had been overtaxed by her father, who wished to train her like a boy, and that she was paying the penalty for undue application in nearsightedness, awkward manners, extravagant tendencies of thought, and a pedantic style of talk that made her a butt for the ridicule of frivolous companions. Margaret herself wrote starkly in her journal, "I made up my mind to be bright and ugly." At age 16, she completed her formal studies. Her male contemporaries were graduating from Harvard, bound for law, medicine, politics, the ministry, and university teaching. In 1826, all of these vocations were closed to women. But Fuller had an extraordinary talent, friendship. In groups, she tended to declaim with learned ostentation, but in individual conversation, she was capable of drawing out the most reserved soul. She could not make a journey or go to an evening party, Ralph Waldo Emerson recalled, without meeting a new person who wished presently to impart his history to her. It was Fuller's skill at conversation, far more than writing, that made her famous. Another Unitarian friend, the Reverend Frederick Henry Hedge, observed, "Her speech, though finished and true as the most deliberate rhetoric of the pen, had always an air of spontaneity which made it seem the grace of the moment, the result of some organic provision which made finished sentences as natural to her as blundering and hesitation are to most of us." Emerson called her conversation the most entertaining in America. But even her friend Channing conceded that her intense self-certainty and acerbic satire could overwhelm. She paid slight heed to the trim palings of etiquette, but swept through the garden beds and into the doorway of one's confidence so cavalierly that a reserved person felt inclined to lock himself up in his sanctum. For a woman, the price of intellectual distinction was sexual disqualification. "I love best to be a woman," Fuller confessed, "though womanhood is at present too straitly bounded to give me scope." Even could she have found the man who could tolerate her brilliance, the life of letters she craved could not coexist with conjugal domesticity. A married man could retreat to his library for hours on end, at once protected and left alone by his wife. A married woman, obligated to chores and social calls, had no such luxury even before children occupied her sphere. Fuller's relations with American men remained chaste, even when both parties imagined more. A journal entry gives voice to her anguish. "With the intellect," she wrote, "with the intellect I always have, always shall overcome. But the life, my God, shall the life never be sweet?" Fuller found solace in a religious faith that embraced both the Christian Unitarianism of William Ellery Channing and the Transcendentalism of Ralph Waldo Emerson. At the age of 21, she was transformed by a mystical experience. Provoked by the facile optimism of a Unitarian Thanksgiving Day sermon, probably not too different from one of mine, she remembered, "I felt within myself great power and generosity and tenderness, but it seemed to me as if they were all unrecognized and as if it was impossible that they should be used in life. I was only 21. The past was worthless, the future hopeless." After the service, Fuller fled into the dark woods, where the sun suddenly shone with transparent sweetness, and she felt transported. "I saw there was no self, that selfishness was all folly and the result of circumstance, that it was only because I thought self real that I suffered, that I had only to live in the idea of all, and all was mine." "I was for that hour taken up into God." Although she could not preserve that sense of oneness with all things, its memory sustained her the rest of her life. The next year, her father abruptly moved the family to the then remote town of Groton. For 22-year-old Margaret, bred to the heady talk and well-stocked libraries of Cambridge, Groton was a dismal exile. A conversationalist bereft of stimulating conversation, she chafed under the dutiful daughter's domestic chores and feared lest they become her permanent lot. When 3 years later her father died, Fuller took over management of the household and care of her younger siblings. And her nightmare seemed real. Rescue came in a burgeoning friendship with her Concord neighbor, Waldo Emerson. Emerson both admired and challenged Fuller's intellect, while she lowered the drawbridge of his famous self-reliance, calling him to deepen his affections. Margaret made Waldo laugh rather more than he liked. They kept each other on their toes. "You cannot predict her opinion," Emerson marveled. "She sympathizes so fast with all forms of life that she talks never narrowly or hostily, nor betrays, like all the rest, under a thin garb of new words, the old droning cast iron opinions or notions of many years standing." When Emerson, Hedge, Alcott, Parker, and others formed a discussion group they called the Transcendental Club, Fuller was among the inner circle and the first editor of its literary journal, The Dial. Fortified by this company, Fuller hit upon a way to support herself. In an age where the lecture circuit was both popular entertainment and a lucrative vocation for men, Fuller realized that women would pay to join in educational conversations in private homes. More than mere income, these conversations offered a means of elevating women's self-image. By engaging their minds, Fuller would show them their minds were worth engaging, and the equal of men's, though denied their education and their flattery. Fuller's conversations proved a raging success. For 4 years, they were faithfully attended by ladies who braved ridicule or worse from their husbands. One traveled from New York City for these conversations. And one subscriber described the experience, "As I sat there, my heart overflowed with joy at the sight of the bright circle. For I know not where to look for so much character, culture, and so much love of truth and beauty in any other circle of women and girls. The question, the high point from which it was considered, and the earnestness and simplicity of the discussion, as well as the gifts and graces of the speakers, gave it the charm of a platonic dialogue. There was no pretension or pedantry in a word that was said." The conversations faltered only once, when Fuller made the mistake of inviting men, who dominated the discussion while the women lapsed into deferential silence. When Fuller reverted to a women-only format, the magic returned. Inspired by the conversations, Fuller in 1843 published an article demanding complete equality for women, educational, vocational, legal, and political. Defending the right of women to remain unmarried, she condemned the fault of marriage and of the present relation between the sexes, that the woman belongs to the man instead of forming a whole with him. 2 years later, Fuller expanded her article into a book, Woman in the 19th Century. She called upon every woman to form her self-image based upon her own values and to lay aside all thoughts such as she habitually cherishes of being taught and led by men. Only women who respect themselves, she argued, are capable of mature relationships. Union is possible, she wrote, only to those who are units. to be fit for relations in time. Souls, whether of man or woman, must be able to do without them in the spirit. To Fuller, gender meant difference, not dichotomy. Male and female, she wrote, are perpetually passing into one another. Fluid hardens to solid, solid rushes to fluid. There is no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman. In families that I know, some little girls like to saw wood, others to use carpenter's tools. When these tastes are indulged, cheerfulness and good humor are promoted. When they are forbidden, because such things are not proper for girls, they grow sullen and mischievous. To women's vocation, Fuller saw no limit. Let them be sea captains, she declared. Applying her unstinting intellect to other inequalities, Fuller began to speak out for the rights of prisoners, indigenous people, enslaved Africans, and those mired in poverty. In 1846, Fuller sailed to Europe, not as a sea captain, but as the first female foreign correspondent in United States history. In Italy, she felt strangely at home in a way she never had in New England. While visiting St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, she became separated from her companions and realized she was lost in the deepening shadow. Suddenly, a gentleman appeared and offered his assistance. He was Giovanni Angelo Ossoli, at 26, 11 years younger than Margaret. Within weeks, they were lovers. Within months, she gave birth to a son. Motherhood suited Margaret more than anyone might have predicted, including her. She doted on her child. But when the Italian movement for democracy boiled into revolution, Fuller volunteered to direct a military hospital. The human devastation she witnessed there, and the swift collapse of the democratic forces, impressed Fuller with human limitation, including her own. Fuller's marriage drew attention on both sides of the Atlantic, much of it caustic. What a strange story, is it not? Taunted one male observer. Now that the scornful, man-hating Margaret of 40 has got a husband, really no old maid need despair while there is life in her body. Others were scandalized by the likelihood that Fuller had been pregnant on her wedding day. But the passages of war and motherhood had led Fuller to a deeper peace. She counseled her friends not to feel anxious about people's talk concerning me. It's not directed against the real Margaret, but a phantom. People, when they see me, will not generally be inclined to injure me, for they will see the expression of a heart bettered by experience, more humble and tender, more anxious to serve its kind than ever before. Preparing to return to America, Fuller was troubled by frequent reports of shipwreck. She prayed that it may not be my lot to lose my babe in the sea, either by unsolaced sickness or amid the howling waves, or that if I should, it may be brief anguish. And Ossoli, he and I go together. Her last prayer was granted. On July 19, 1850, the ship Elizabeth foundered off Fire Island. As the vessel broke apart, Margaret Fuller and her husband and child drowned in the roiling sea. Just 3 months later, the first National Women's Rights Convention in Worcester drew over 1,000 participants, with more turned away at the doors. Margaret Fuller was to have been a featured speaker. And many had high hopes she would take up the mantle of leadership of the new movement. Had she done so, she might have challenged and guided the American conscience for the next half century. Even with Fuller's life cut short at the age of 40, Elizabeth Cady Stanton called her the most influential woman in history. We will never know how much we lost to the stormy Atlantic that day. By refusing to veil her brilliance in domesticity, Margaret Fuller did not merely assert women's equality, she proved it to a doubting world. Today, as we experience the menace and dread of rising authoritarianism, bigotry, and oppression, we can find wisdom and comfort in Fuller's example. Like Fuller, we can choose to be our authentic selves, never trimming our sails to accommodate the prevailing winds. We can insist upon pointing out the connections among the injustices suffered by diverse communities in our society. We can risk our lives to oppose tyranny wherever it threatens. Most of all, we can cultivate communities of affection, joy, and resistance to sustain us through our shared struggles. Communities like Arlington Street Church. You can still read the inscription on Margaret Fuller's memorial in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. By birth, a child of New England. By adoption, a citizen of Rome. By genius, belonging to the world. Amen. And blessed be. The words of Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to live mightily, to bow to the mystery. May love hold us all until we meet again. Our worship is ended. Our service begins. Amen. Oh,
please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.